Forever Solvers, the holidays are coming, and that means gift giving. We have a bunch of fabulous new merch over at resolvedmysteriespodcast.com/merch. There are shirts and totes and mugs and other gifty goodies. We also now have a sponsor page, which has some great gift ideas like Unidragon puzzles and Audible subscriptions. And there are some other unique gift opportunities for fans of RM, like sending your honey some love on our Resolved Mysteries billboard or signing them up for our Patreon. So head over to resolvedmysteriespodcast.com and click on advertising and support for more information.
This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
All right. Well, let's make a podcast. What do you say?
Let's do this.
Oh, okay.
Welcome, listeners, to Season 4, Episode 16, Part 1 of Resolved Mysteries. This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And I'm Carlin.
And welcome to the show. As most of you know, for every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's is the Trevor Project. Founded in 1998, the Trevor Project is the leading national organization providing crisis intervention and suicide prevention services to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning LGBTQ young people under 25. And it was suggested to us by our patron, Raina R.
Oh, yay!
Wonderful. I love that we're supporting this for right around the holidays time. This is nice.
That's great. And Raina is one of our truest honeys, honestly.
Yes. And we love Raina. So thank you, Raina.
Yeah, thank you.
And if you want to support the Trevor Project, you can leave a review and we'll donate a dollar. We've got some patrons to shout out. Who wants to do that?
Maybe Eliza does because I have the first segment.
I can do it. Okay, great. Eliza, go ahead, girl.
Okay.
Thank you to Justin W., Sarah W., Ethan, Kate P., Desiree L., Jessica A., Marlena, hopefully I'm pronouncing this right, Carl Mais, J., and Judy H.
Thank you, honeys. If you'd like to support us on Patreon, you're going to get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, along with goodies in the mail. Head to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. Oh, and you guys, so Justin picked our poison on our website, which is truly something that we set up when we first started doing this, and I don't think anybody has done this before.
No.
But on our website, under advertising and sponsorship, you can pick our poison, and for a recording, you can donate $15, and then we will drink the cocktail that you recommend. But here is what – so Justin picked our poison, and this is what Justin had to say. Justin says, hello, it's Justin from Streetsboro, Ohio. I'm a member on Patreon, which is nice because Justin's already supporting us. So oh, yeah. Thank you.
Much over, honey.
Just wanted to show some extra love and support. Not really a cocktail drinker, but my poison is tequila.
Boy.
Uh-oh. See you later, rest of the episode. Does anybody have any funny tequila stories? LOL. Anyway, sending all my best. Blessings and support. Your Midwest tequila buddy.
Oh.
Which is so nice. So now we all have our tequila, and we're all going to do a shot together.
What's everybody got? I've got El Jimador. It is a tequila silver.
I have got Terramana, the Rock, Dwayne the Rock Johnson's tequila.
Funny, wow. Because I have Casamigos, which is George Clooney's tequila.
Uh-huh, I love Casamigos.
So we are drinking the nectar of the gods right now.
My tequila is not backed by a celeb, but it's also not backed by a white person.
We love it.
Well, thank you, Justin. Cheers to you. Let's do this.
Okay.
And forgive us for the content that's coming ahead of this.
Oh.
Ugh.
Oh.
At least it's not the morning. At least we're recording in the afternoon.
Jesus.
Okay. Justin, thank you so much.
Well, my tequila, I have a, not, it's not that funny of a tequila story, but it's more, how shall I say, traumatic in that.
This is adding up.
One night, my friend and I had a babysitter for my child, and my friend, one of my best friends, was living with us, and we felt free, and so we went to a wine bar, and then we came home, and before our husbands got home, we took shots of tequila, and by the time they got home, we were in a full fight about whether or not Lisa Kudrow is a good actor or not.
Oh my gosh, and I think I might have gotten a text that night.
Oh, you probably did, and I'm still very mad about it because he's never watched Friends. I just felt like he did not have a leg to stand on at all.
He doesn't get a vote.
He does. That's what I said. But we were
Wait,
so.
Is this Sean? I'll cut that.
Yeah. Oh, you can say no, who it is. I don't mind. He'll never listen to it. But it was just, it's still like we can't really talk about it without getting really mad at each other. And like the next morning, it was horrible. Oh, I think we ended up like hitting each other.
And tequila. Then the next tequila's a rough drunk.
Yeah. And then the next morning we live in the same house, so we had to like it was so awkward, and it's still no one allows us to talk about Lisa Kudrow. So and our husbands are truly they're the ones actually who are traumatized by seeing us in that state. I agree.
Oh, Lisa Kudrow debate.
Oh my gosh,
I'm going to have to talk to him about this.
I love it.
You don't want to. You don't want to have this experience that I did. It almost broke our friendship.
That's great.
Okay.
See what tequila can do.
Well, yeah. Justin, thank you for being such a troublemaker. And listeners, if you want to support the podcast, you can pick our poison. You can go to resolvemysteriespodcast.com. And if you select advertising and support from the info dropdown, there's a bunch of different ways to support the show. So, Justin, again, thank you for doing this. It was great. All right. So what are we covering in this two-part episode, ladies?
Okay, part one is an unexplained Seggy, and it is about the Medjugorje miracles.
And then I have an unexplained death about Scott Johnson.
And then I kick it off in part two with a wanted segment, and it's Angela Hammond.
And then we've got a missing segment about Lee Young.
Ready?
Let's go. Can't wait for some miracles.
I can't wait for some tequila miracles.
So this is an unexplained Seggy. It's about the Medjugorje miracles. And I was talking last time we recorded about how, we were talking about trading segments maybe. And I was like, no, it's fine. I've already talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I did a whole segment about this before.
Yeah, right? Sure did.
You did, right?
Well, that's what I thought, but I did not.
No.
It was a small mention in a segment that I did.
Oh,
we must just remember, like, the name.
Well, the problem is I had fallen down a rabbit hole last time.
Yeah.
And did a lot of research about something that wasn't really, like, the main thing of the segment.
Okay, that makes sense, because I was like, why is Stack not saying, we already covered this, and
yes,
here we are
they've
again.
Definitely talked about it. They sure have talked about it, but it was a very brief mention in the intro to the Blinking Jesus segment.
Okay.
Is what it was.
And I was going to say, once I watched the Yeti segment, I was like, okay, well, then it doesn't matter if Carlin already did Bigfoot, because it's like a totally different story.
Yeah. So. Well, I did talk about the Yeti in my Bigfoot one.
Yeah,
as well,
you did. But. So that's what you get for deep diving.
That's what I get. That's what I fucking get, is feeling like I've already done this segment before.
Yeah, way to do a good job, dummy.
So last time, I remember that I did a lot of, like, I deep dived into one of the women who was one of the visionaries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes.
Because she has a lot of YouTube videos, and she would make these pilgrimages to go talk to Mary, like.
Okay, right.
Mm-hmm. In Medjugorje, and like thousands of people would gather around her and watch her like speaking to Mary and all this stuff. So
yeah,
that's why I feel like I've been here before.
You have already witnessed the miracle.
Yes. So that was in season two. I don't remember. I think season two, episode two, it's called Totally Nake. And we did talk about the blinking Jesus and a little bit about Medjugorje. Okay. So.
We're so good at naming episodes.
Oh, my gosh.
We'll never stop being amazing at it.
So the segment opens with a girl with sores all over her body, restlessly flailing around on her bed and acting paranoid. Stack tells us that it's 1986 in Chicago, Illinois, and, quote, former model Jill Jensen is so strung out on cocaine she has gouged open sores over her entire body. And we'll come back to this scary reenactment a little bit later.
Can't wait.
Stack then switches it up and tells us someone else's story. He says 500 miles away, Rita Klaus is suffering the very painful effects of MS. So then Stack tells us that what these two women have in common is a small Yugoslavian village called Medjugorje. And the year after this segment aired is when that that area changed to Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Oh, yeah.
It's no longer called Yugoslavia right there. But
I love Bosnia. It's awesome.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, some of the pictures I saw, mm-hmm. I was like, I want to go.
And they have no tourism, so everyone there is really nice because they're trying to, like, build up tourism. So it's super cheap, and you can, like, basically stay in someone's upstairs in their house. Like, it's
wow.
So cool. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it looks really beautiful. Mm-hmm. So Stack then gives us a little bit of a brief of the story of these six young kids who, quote, call themselves visionaries. So this is what was briefly mentioned in the Blinking Jesus segment. In the intro, Stack talks about just miracles in general and how there's only a few miracles that have been, quote, confirmed. And these visionary children were one of the miracles he mentioned. They give the transcript of one boy who was there and saw this vision of Mary. And he describes, quote, Our Lady, a.k.a. Mary, hovering on a cloud. Then he says, four of the young visionaries still say they communicate with the Virgin at 6:40 p.m. each day. So that woman that I mentioned before, Mariana Soldo, was one of those four because she went on to communicate with Mary a lot. And
hey, girl, what's up?
All the YouTube videos and all this stuff. Stack then tells us how Medjugorje has become this mecca for Catholic pilgrimages. So he says that 10 years after the epiphany of the six kids, hundreds of people have claimed to be healed while visiting Medjugorje. So now Stack is going to walk us through a few different Medjugorje miracles. First, he talks about Joe Romano, who he says was cured of abdominal cancer after he and his wife took 3 trips to Medjugorje.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Also, probably combined with chemotherapy, I'm going to guess. Or?
Well, we only pretty much get one sentence about that. Okay. So,
no follow-up questions allowed. No one's taking questions on that one. Okay.
Then we have Kevin Giebel. Stack says since he was born, Kevin had been, quote, plagued with digestive abnormalities, profoundly weak muscles, and an inadequate immune system. Which,
I mean, same.
I mean, who among
sounds
us?
Like every child in my life. So I don't know what profoundly weak means, if that's like he couldn't walk or like he was a little kid.
Who had diarrhea.
Yeah. Who also had IBS. But when he was 7, he went to Medjugorje with his parents, and now he's 9 and his symptoms have virtually disappeared.
Love it.
Okay.
Because he got older.
Is he the one, is the stomach cancer the one that went 3 times?
Yeah. That's the guy, the first guy, not okay. The kid.
Yeah, 3
yeah,
trips.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Whew, that's commitment.
Then he tells us about Char Vance, and Char Vance definitely has the haircut you would picture someone named Char to have.
Char, what a name. We got to bring it back.
For Char.
Char's right leg was shattered in a farm accident, and Char said that her doctor said it was the worst break they'd ever seen, but she said her leg miraculously healed at Medjugorje. Stack then says, while it may seem crazy that people think miraculous healing can happen at a location where someone had a vision, if you or your loved one is suffering a medical issue, there's always going to be a small glimmer of hope in the back of your mind.
Sure.
And I was like, nail on head, Mr. Stack.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, desperate people mm-hmm. are gonna grab mm-hmm. onto things. Mm-hmm. So now we get to the featured miracles in this segment. So first we have Jill Jensen. Jill grew up upper middle class outside of Chicago. As a teen, she started experimenting with drugs and she became addicted to cocaine. So then we have an interview with Jill. And right off the bat, I would say there's just something kind of dead behind her eyes. I don't know if you guys felt that way, too.
Yeah. I mean, Jill's still alive, so we have to be careful what we say. But
oh, no, I'll talk about it.
Okay.
She's definitely still alive.
Was she heavily medicated during this interview? Because that's what she seems like.
Yes.
Okay.
There's something off, right?
Yeah, like, that's how I felt, but I didn't know if it was, like, mental illness or, like, heavy medication or something.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. But basically, her eyes do not express, which is weird to me.
Yes.
So she says she doesn't think there was really a day that went by that she didn't use cocaine. She said she'd have it in her jackets, in her purse, hidden in her car.
Me too, though. Me too.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Like, I'm going to cut this. This segment is hysterical. And can I just say that I was watching it on double speed, so it really made me feel like I was doing cocaine while I was watching it. Yeah, it was thrilling. It's the most fun I've had in a very long time. But I have to say that I had bags of cocaine all over my body, and I never once, like, ripped a hole into my flesh.
Okay, we're going to get to that. I need to ask questions.
Okay.
So
ask a former drug user.
The bugs.
Okay, okay.
Okay, sorry.
So she got to a point where she said she was unable to do anything unless she was using it. She said she needed it to wake up, to sleep, to function on a daily basis.
No, you don't take it to sleep, though.
Mm-hmm. I was like, what? That makes absolutely no sense.
No, you take Xanax to sleep.
Yeah. Stack explains that by the time Jill was 26, she had a $500 a day habit.
Oh, my God.
So in perspective, that's a little bit over $1,000 a day now. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Stack says Jill was in and out of rehabs constantly. They didn't work. And she was now at the point of freebasing cocaine because
that's when you start picking at your skin.
Okay. Because so, like, her constant use had burned a hole in the lining of her nose.
Yeah. So, like, they're talking about cocaine, but the picking at your skin thing, that's smoking crack. You're freebasing cocaine, which is smoking crack. So that's when he said smoking it, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That makes
sense. She said smoking it, and I was like, oh, smoking it. Okay.
Big diff.
So then we have this very scary reenactment that we had in the intro, but it's full length, and it's Jill being strung out. She's in a dimly lit, messy room. She's on her bed. She looks like a total zombie. She is covered in sores.
Covered.
Her face just looks like she is dead.
The actress is so amazing.
The actress is good.
Yeah, all the reenactors in this episode are incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I can totally see if you were a little kid. Like,
yeah, it's very
that whole, like, fear of drugs thing. Like, they're setting you up to think that drugs are the scariest thing ever.
Yes.
So Jill says that she started to hallucinate. She would see bugs all over herself and be fixated on getting them off. So she'd rip her skin open and rip her hair out. And for years, she was covered in sores.
Mm-hmm.
So the reenactment is just so scary. She's writhing around. She rips like a ball of her hair out and she's like pulling the ball apart, like looking through it. She's horrified looking at her skin and she's just like in terror in her own body.
Yeah.
And I was like, this looks like a meth addict. Like, what is this? This is really extreme.
Well, that's why, like, if they would have said that she was doing speed, that would have been one thing because that is amphetamine. But they kept saying cocaine. Right. And I guess, like, smoking crack, it makes a little bit more sense. But it did very much seem like she was on an amphetamine, you know?
Yeah, because I had a friend that was addicted to meth for a while. And she told me that, like, she thought that there was little bits of glass in her skin. Mm. So she would, like, try to get them out.
Oh, God.
And, like, that's part of where, like, the sores come from and stuff. And I was like, that's what this girl looked like. Like, it's the same kind of thing.
It's funny, like, even Karen from MFM, she used to do a ton of speed and, like, talk about over-plucking. Like you just like it doesn't even have to be necessarily like or like popping a pimple or something. Mm-hmm. Like you just get fixated on something, you know, and that's kind of it doesn't even have to be like it doesn't even have to be like I'm covered in bugs. It just becomes like you're fixated and you just like go to town on whatever you're fixated on.
So it's all very scary. Jill's aunt Dee Olson is interviewed and she says that Jill was scrawny, anorexic, she had circles under her eyes and she looked much older than she actually was. She explains that Jill used to be so beautiful and she actually did modeling for a while. And they show this glorious 80s glamour shot of Jill where she, like there's a fan like blowing her hair out like a lion's mane and there's like lights around her. She's very pretty.
Yeah.
In 1988, Dee Dee went to Medjugorje, and when she came back, she wanted to convince Jill to go back with her. A year later, Jill agreed to go with her aunt to Medjugorje, even though she was really concerned about taking a 14-hour flight without cocaine.
Amateur.
You're like, isn't it in your pockets, girl?
I mean, girl, come on.
She explains how bad the withdrawals were for her because she's like, I'd been through them before. Headaches, sleeplessness, nightmares, cold sweats, hot flashes, generally just feeling sick. But she says something came over her to give her the willingness to try. So they go to Medjugorje. They explained earlier in the segment that so many people would come make this pilgrimage that they would have to like set up little mini confessionals like around the church. Mm-hmm. Some were inside, some were outside, like they were just everywhere. Mm-hmm. So she goes to one of these little makeshift confessionals and she meets with an American priest and she starts her confession and she ends up backing up the lines for over an hour as she talks to this priest.
Typical.
So she's telling him about how bad her addiction is and the bugs and she's like showing him her sores.
The line though, the line is so funny. It's so long. So many people waiting to improve their lives, but this girl's like, and then, and then.
I'm sure like on average it was like a 5-minute thing and she's here taking over. She's just sitting. So he ends up blessing her sores with holy water, which like was like this metal wand with like a ball on the end. And he's like waving it over her and stuff. And so Jill says by that night, all her sores started closing up. She says she didn't feel it happening, but every time she'd look at them, they'd be more and more closed up despite years of never healing.
Yes, because you're not doing drugs currently, so you're not picking your skin. That's how the skin works. It actually heals very, very quickly.
It does, yeah. It wants
I was
going to
say,
heal.
I've truly had wounds heal in like a day or two.
Yes.
Yeah.
As long as you're not smoking crack and picking at them, they're going to, they're going to heal pretty quickly.
Stack says within a few days, Jill's sores were almost gone and she hadn't experienced any symptoms of withdrawal. So Aunt Dee Dee definitely took this to level 10. She set up a meeting with one of the visionaries. She was like, we're having the full Medjugorje experience.
Yes, girl. Upgrade us. Upgrade us.
So she has a meeting with one of the visionaries and she... Oh, the visionary blessed Jill with a prayer to Virgin Mary. So the visionary put her hands on Jill and her aunt's heads, and she prayed to Mary. And Jill says it felt like electricity almost. She had a tremendous feeling of warmth and well-being.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice when someone cares about you and touches you like they care about you, right?
Yeah. Yep.
There's a lot of science behind that.
Stack tells us that 3 years later, Jill is still drug-free. She speaks at school drug prevention programs and works as a cosmetologist. And to this day, Jill claims to have never experienced a single symptom of withdrawal.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Maureen R. Kelly, director of the Women's Chemical Dependency Center at Columbus Hospital, says that it is rare for someone as severe and late stage as Jill to be able to just quit, especially without experiencing severe withdrawal, both physical and psychological. So then Stack comes back in a church and he says... It must be pointed out that thousands of people, none of whom have ever heard of Medjugorje, kick drug habits each year.
Thanks, Stack. Thank you.
I think this is my favorite Stack. Like, twice in this segment already, he's just coming in to, like, keep it real quick.
Or just like, hey, you can quit drugs without making a very expensive trip.
Yeah.
Yes. He says, yet Jill Jensen is convinced that her pilgrimage was pivotal to her recovery. Okay, so on to the next miracle. Stack says that Rita Klaus has always devoted herself to God. They say that at just 15, Rita entered a convent in Omaha, Nebraska. So pause right here to say that if you still haven't listened to The Turning, you gotta listen to The Turning.
Ooh, Carlin's a convert, no pun intended.
Oh my gosh. Because, well, and it's like, nobody else has done that, like, inner view of, like, what it truly is like to be in the order.
Yeah.
So it's really good. If you still haven't listened to it, do it. 5 years after entering the convent, Rita was diagnosed with MS, which Stack tells us is degenerative and incurable. As Rita's symptoms got worse, she felt she had no choice but to withdraw from the order. Rita explains how devastating this was. Mm. She was 28 and had spent 13 years in the convent. Mm. She literally says in the interview, "It was my life." And, like, yeah. Listen to The Turning. It is their life. Mm-hmm. So Rita says she loved it dearly and knew she wouldn't see it again. Rita moved to Pennsylvania and taught special education. She met Ron Klaus, an elementary school teacher, and 3 years later, they got married. By this time, Rita's symptoms had pretty much disappeared, and she thought she had been misdiagnosed. Within 5 years, Rita and Ron had 3 daughters, and after their youngest, Heidi, was born, Rita started having MS symptoms again. So she tried to just ignore it, but one day while she was holding her baby, Heidi, her right arm just gave out.
Oh, my gosh.
So they have a very dramatic reenactment of Heidi dropping to the floor.
Oh, my gosh.
And it gave me flashbacks to I'm still traumatized to when I dropped my cousin when she was a baby. Right on her head.
No.
I didn't know that.
Is Nicole, she a serial killer now?
Oh, I fully dropped Nicole. And my right arm didn't give out. I just, you know, like turned the wrong way or something happened and I was a stupid kid.
You were a weak baby with digestive problems.
Exactly. So they do this dramatic reenactment of Heidi dropping to the floor. Rita explains that other than being scared and having a couple bruises, Heidi was okay, but Rita was really scared.
Yeah.
Stack explains Rita's symptoms got worse. By the end of 1984, her vision blurred, her bladder didn't function properly, and she lost almost all feeling in her feet and lower legs.
Ugh.
So they show, like, this professional church photo of her and some other people, and she's in a wheelchair in this photo.
Mm-hmm.
Stack says she used a wheelchair, and sometimes on good days she'd use crutches. Ron Klaus says it was hard to watch her going downhill, but sometimes it would seem rapid and sometimes it would slow down and sometimes it would even off and certain functions of her body that she thought she'd lost would come back again. So, I mean, I can't imagine how confusing that is to live your life like
yes.
that. But over time, she would lose these functions again. In 1986, Rita learned about Medjugorje and started studying the phenomenon. Rita would pray to Mary and also started fasting twice a week because this was something that the young visionaries said they had been told to do.
Hmm.
So she's kind of just like getting her Medjugorje experience from home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Rita says she would look at books of Medjugorje and she wanted to go so badly, but she knew that physically and financially there was no way she could make the trip. One night while praying for others, as she always did, Rita heard a voice and it said, "Why don't you ask? Why don't you ask?"
You sounded like Moira Rose.
That's what the voice kind of sounded like. So Rita prayed to Mary to ask her son to heal her. I love how it's like Mary as the middleman. It's uh-huh. like we yeah. can't. That's one thing about Catholicism that I'm confused by.
Yeah.
So Rita says that as soon as she finished her prayer, she felt a feeling like electricity through her body, but especially on the right side of her body where she had most of her issues. She thought, "This isn't happening to me," and went to sleep. The next morning, Rita had no memory of hearing the voice or doing the prayer. She went to a class she'd been taking at the local college. I know.
Okay.
I know. Okay. She had no memory, okay?
But how do we know?
But she when did it come back?
Oh, I'll tell you. So they have this whole reenactment. Ron is helping her into her car that's, like, specially rigged for her to be able to drive it. And she says that halfway through her class, she felt a rush of heat and suddenly she could feel. She says, "I could feel there were wrinkles inside my shoes." And I think she's talking about, like, when your sock is bunched up inside
the
your
worst.
Shoe.
That's the first Which feeling she gets back.
Truly the worst feeling.
Torture.
It's a very rude awakening. So She says she can move her toes, which she had been unable to do for years. She was totally dumbfounded because she didn't remember anything from the night before, but she knew something was happening. She said she could feel the strength coming back into her legs. She got herself out of the car with no problem. She hadn't walked on her own in more than 4 years. And in the reenactment, she just walks right in the house. Mm-hmm. She calls for her family. She stands at the bottom of the stairs waiting for them. She says as she stood there at the bottom of the stairs, she had flashbacks to the voice she heard and the prayer she'd been given the night before. And it was then that she knew she'd been healed. So in the reenactment, she just takes off her leg braces. She starts like gently walking up the stairs and then realizing it's fine. And she ends up running up the stairs. She like does a spin when she gets to the top, and she says she was just screaming, and she ran back down the stairs all the way out the front door screaming, "Thank you, God. Thank you, Blessed Mother." So Stack says that 6 months went by and Rita's symptoms did not come back. After 15 years of suffering, she was able to function normally. Rita and Ron believe she was healed by a miracle of faith. We have Dr. Richard Kasdorf, an expert in, quote, so-called spontaneous healings. That's what Stack says. Kasdorf says it could be considered a miraculous event if you want to call it that, because you don't just see 20 years of disability clear instantly. Over a reenactment of Rita and Ron ice skating together, Stack says it's now been 6 years since Rita threw away her crutches and she has not had a single symptom since. Stack wraps the segment and says, "Is Rita Claus's cure a miracle that can be ascribed to the Virgin at Medjugorje?" The Catholic Church is publicly skeptical but continues to investigate. On the other hand, Webster's Dictionary defines a miracle not only in standard religious terms, but also simply as a wonderful thing. By this definition, Jill Jensen drug-free and Rita Claus ice skating are miracles even non-believers can celebrate.
They are wonderful things. I will agree.
Yes. So,
what's the update?
So, I mean, there's just no way to prove that a miracle happened. I'm sorry. Yeah. There's just no way to prove
that's why it's called a miracle.
But I did look into a couple of things. So first I looked into Jill Jensen's situation, and there's a couple things I take issue with. And Jill going from having a cocaine addiction described in the segment by the lady from the Chemical Dependency Center as severe one day, to having no symptoms of withdrawal over her 14-hour plane trip or ever again after that. I just cannot believe that that is true.
No.
I just cannot.
No.
Not if she was at the level that she was at.
Well, unless it was a miracle.
Or unless she believed that she wasn't having them, right? Like, I mean, a lot of withdrawal, it's physical, but it's also psychosomatic. So maybe she just convinced herself that being at Medjugorje, she didn't have them, and whatever she was feeling, she kind of downplayed instead of
having
it emotionally escalate.
Yeah. And then the sores healing, like, in the rate that she described it, like, we just discussed, it can happen pretty fast, but, like, she basically described it happening before her eyes, and I don't believe that either.
She was probably also delirious, like, she was going through withdrawal.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
And so, okay. So quitting a severe cocaine addiction cold turkey not only sounds like something she could not have done, it is something that is not recommended to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's
true. I looked at several resources from, like, different rehabs, and it is, they're truly, like, do not do this. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not only, like, a horrible feeling, it's dangerous mm-hmm. to yeah. do.
You have to go to detox.
Mm-hmm. Causes yes. seizures. Yeah. It can be terrible.
So I really don't think that's what happened to Jill. If it really did, then it's a fucking miracle.
Seriously, that's what I'm saying. Like, all this is not true unless it was a miracle.
Yeah. That's basically it, right?
But what we cannot say is whether or not it happened because she went to Yugoslavia. Like, Yugoslavia looks great. I would love to see it. I'm not shit-talking Yugoslavia, but
hell no. Dream.
I do not think that a miracle is waiting for you in a specific city in the world.
No.
But Jill today, I did find Jill on Facebook. It is clear that she stayed clean. She looks amazing.
Yay!
She looks like she lives a really happy life. According to LinkedIn, she is the lead creative and social media manager for KidSnips.
Cute!
She's a master stylist and salon manager.
Love it.
She's still really pretty, her face now has life to it. Like, in every picture, she does not look like that girl in that interview.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if, like, they were filming that just, like, too soon after.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was reading about, like, severe cocaine addiction changes your brain chemistry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I don't think she was well, like, yeah. during that filming.
Yeah.
But now she's got kids and grandkids, and she's definitely still religious. And just in general, she looks like a good person. Like,
Yay!
She looks like she's really happy.
It worked out for Jill.
So our second miracle, Rita Klaus. I just want to hear, like, how did you guys feel about Rita in the segment?
Well, Rita was already very religious, right? Mm-hmm. So she's more inclined to believe in a miracle and things like that. Mm-hmm. Also, how, like, Rita doesn't really count because she didn't go to Medjugorje.
That's right? what I'm saying.
And so it's like she's had symptoms of MS completely recede before in
exactly.
her life.
Exactly.
Yes,
like, MS she has. Is a really tricky disease that way, you know?
But, like, her
that's
as
why
a person.
It's hard to pin down initially.
Her as a person. I found her to be really, like, genuine seeming
oh
and,
God.
Like, believable and...
Listen, I believe that she believes, you know?
Yeah. So I researched Rita, and Rita sure did keep talking about miracles.
Oh, okay.
You can find Rita in a few videos on YouTube.
Oh.
Talking about miracles and prayers and voices that have spoken to her.
That's great. I mean, she's like a little American Medjugorje. She's like a mm-hmm. little mini representative.
You can find an hour and 45 minute speech she gives at a certain convention. And you can hear Rita reciting her miraculous story with such drama and conviction that it will make you want to barf. Because she is fully, like, putting on a show for vulnerable people.
Like, but she probably believes it, right? Or do you think she's being exploitative?
The vibes in that YouTube video, like, completely flipped my view on her.
Oh, no. It's like Hillsong kind of stuff. Like,
honey.
Okay.
So I jumped around in the speech because it was an hour and 45 minutes. I was not about to listen to the whole thing. But I was, like, trying to find the part where she's talking about Medjugorje. And this is how I learned that she keeps in close contact with Mary and Jesus on the reg. I also heard her talk about her daughter. Her beloved daughter apparently made her so proud by protesting outside abortion clinics.
Oh, shut up. Oh,
she says her daughter really wanted even women who had been raped to have their babies.
Oh, my fucking God.
And,
Rita.
But it doesn't end there. Her daughter is such a good person. She would even offer to babysit for them if they had the babies.
Okay. Go ahead,
okay.
then.
We so like it's easy. That. Just do it. Okay?
Oh, no.
It was at this point that I closed the YouTube window and was like, fuck this. So Rita is... God. I do not feel the same anymore.
Rita's
I do not feel the same.
Off the chain. We lost Rita. Rita down. We lost her.
Yeah, bummer.
Oof. She also wrote a book because she really wanted to cash out on that miracle,
of course.
Honey.
Well, you gotta.
So I also looked up MS and whether or not you can recover from it. You cannot.
No.
It is incurable.
Yeah.
Then I looked up what other disorders can seem like MS.
Mm.
So thankfully WebMD was like, we got you, girl. Here's 20 things.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
That can have, like, the same appearance as MS, because MS is one of those things that does not. It's not the same in every person.
Yeah.
Well, and at first she says she did wonder if she had been misdiagnosed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So turns out there's a lot of things that can seem like MS. Hmm. And one that really caught my eye was Lyme disease.
Oh.
So the reasons being, the symptoms being very similar, the fact that you can have it for years, and the fact that it can just go away.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm no doctor. I'm just saying I think that a very obvious answer to this unsolved mystery is that Rita did have something going on with her health, but she was misdiagnosed with MS.
Wow.
She obviously had something else, but it cleared up, so it was not MS. The fact that she didn't even go to Medjugorje, I also wrote, like Allison said, it just really confused me as to, like, we have these two people, like, main feature on the segment, and she didn't even go there.
Especially yeah. when they found three other examples of people who did go to Medjugorje.
Yes!
Why mention them?
It was a weird choice.
It's like watching a concert on video and saying that you were there. Like, it's not the same thing.
It's
exactly.
Like, I can watch like a million that. Performances of Beyonce, but I've never seen her live. You know, like, yeah. Come on.
100%. Totally different. And she was a nun for half her life. Like, at the point that she was diagnosed with MS, she had been a nun half her life. She stayed very religious, and she's trying to tell us that she had never once before prayed for her own healing.
Yeah, come on.
Come on.
Why don't you ask?
And then also the sad
Alexis.
Thing. Truly. And the sad
Fold
thing
in
of
the cheese.
Being a part of a religion where you have to ask instead of it just happening for you. Why does that have to be?
That's
thing?
What I said. I was like, is that a Catholic
this is
thing?
A real, like, this is a real slippery slope, ladies. We don't have time for this.
I know. But I was like, what? That doesn't make sense to me. And she was probably praying all the time. To say that this happened to her because she prayed. I'm like, girl, you were always praying. Yeah. You've been praying.
Yeah.
For like your entire life. So as for Medjugorje itself, it is still believed by many to be a holy location, and people definitely still pilgrimage there, honey.
Wow.
So it looks like the Catholic Church still does not officially back the idea that it is a place where miracles happen.
Uh-huh.
And they haven't authenticated the six visionaries either. But I did find an article from a Catholic publication called Crux in 2019, and it was titled, Vatican Turning More Benevolent Eye to Medjugorje Apparitions. So it's like they're warming up to the idea.
I don't think that would be good PR for them. I don't know if they're going to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Right. So there's quotes in here from Polish Archbishop Henryk Hozer, the Holy See's special envoy to Medjugorje. And this is from a 2019 interview with the publication of Italian bishops called Avenir. So Hozer pointed to the number of conversions, vocations, and sacraments that take place at the pilgrimage site as an example of the positive effects that this place has on the Catholic community, adding that he doesn't believe there are any traces of hearsay. Hozer, 76, was appointed to his role by Pope Francis in February 2017 and is today in charge of administering to the pastoral needs of pilgrims and serving as a liaison between the local Franciscan community and the Catholic hierarchy. 1 year after his appointment, the Polish prelate announced that pilgrimages were allowed once again to Medjugorje, the last step of an ongoing debate regarding how much official Vatican backing should be given to the popular, albeit ambiguous, site. Quote, people claim to feel the presence of Mary, Hozer said, but allowing pilgrimages must not be interpreted as an authentication of the known events tied to the name Medjugorje.
Oh, that's convenient, Vatican.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're like, keep coming, keep spending, mm-hmm. but we're not validating.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And this is all from the article. Beloved by Catholic faithfuls, especially from Italy and Eastern Europe, this Marian site is Europe's third most popular pilgrimage destination after Lourdes, France, and Fatima, Portugal. According to media reports, over 30 million believers have come to Medjugorje since the first apparitions were reported.
Wow.
So then in the article, Hozer talks about the six visionaries a bit, and the article had this to say. Three of the visionaries claim that Mary appears to them each day, while the remaining three say they have the same experience once a year.
Oh, big diff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the other three are like, why not me?
That's what I was thinking when they said only three of them still talk to her every day at 6:40.
Yeah, that's...
Oh, we're going to reference that in just a sec.
Okay.
So over the years, the Catholic Church has done a couple of like official investigations into Medjugorje, and the most recent one, there was like a report put out in 2014. Quote, personally, I am more skeptical, Pope Francis said aboard the papal plane returning from the Marian shrine at Fatima in May 2017. I prefer Our Lady to be a mother, our mother, and not a telegraph operator who sends out a message every day at a certain time. Oh. This is not the mother of Jesus.
Oh,
quote, okay. Who thinks Our Lady would say, come tomorrow at this time and I will give a message to that seer? No, he added.
Damn.
Ouch.
The Pope said that the Ruini report expressed the need for more investigation on the original apparitions and expressed doubts concerning the yearly apparitions that have occurred since. But Francis added that the real core of this report was the spiritual devotions elicited from the pilgrimage site. So he's like explaining, like, all these really great things, like these meetings of priests and this this mother that hosts orphans and women in crisis and drug addicts and stuff all happens in this city, and it makes it feel really like something's happening here, you know?
Yeah.
Quote, I can testify that at Medjugorje, the Mother of God is at the heart of everything, independently from eventual supernatural occurrences. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I think is happening. Like,
it's just good vibes.
It's like all around. A bunch of people are gathering in a place and you see other people having an experience.
Yeah.
You know, you want to have that experience too. And it's easy to say it happened because I'm here and because of this presence. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is happening.
I also agree with you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, like, if we want to call a miracle just, like,
a good thing.
A really good thing that happened and we can't explain why, then yes, these are miracles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They are. But I don't think we can say they happened because they went to this holy site.
Agreed. Yeah.
Lastly, I did check in on that woman, Mariana Soldo.
Oh, yeah.
That's been, I mean, truly, honey, the endless YouTube videos. Her thing was that Mary would appear to her on the second day of the month each month at, it was like 10 or 11 a.m., like each time, the same.
Okay.
Which, again, even the Pope is like, I don't think that's how Mary works. But apparently in 2020, Mary told Mariana she would no longer be appearing to her.
Because of COVID?
So she's like, it's just not safe. I haven't gotten my vax yet.
Well, yeah. She was like, listen, everybody has to get vaxxed at Medjugorje.
You might be right. Because on March 18th, 2020, Mariana announced that the Blessed Mother would no longer appear to her at that time, the second of each month.
Yeah, COVID. Yeah. It's affected all of us.
But, like, I think I had said in our last segment about that woman that, like, I can't believe she's still doing this. Like, she's getting really old. And, like, in the videos, they're having to, like, help her up the mountain. And, like, it seems really dangerous. And, like, suddenly last year, she's like, Mary told me she's not coming anymore.
She's like, no one is wearing a fucking mask and I am too old. So Mary told me no more. That's it. I'm retiring. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah.
Well, I think that you did an incredible job with this segment.
With this
segment
you've been given.
With the segment you've been given by our Blessed Virgin Mary, yes. Queen of the Lord, or whatever her title
Queen
is,
of
Mother
Peace.
Of Dragons. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Okay, so get ready for a saddie.
Yeah.
Y'all. This involves children dying. I'm just going to say it because it does, and it's sad. So, the Johnson family moved to Bullhead City, Arizona from California in 1973. Sue Johnson, the mother of the family, and her husband, who's not featured in this segment at all and is also not featured as, like, a reenactor at all, which I thought was kind of interesting, felt it was a great place to raise their children, Scott Johnson and Angel Johnson. Scott was 7 and Angel was 8. So 7-year-old Scott especially loved playing outside, and his mother explains that Scott was a natural-born fisherman. He loved to fish and go out in the desert, catch lizards, catch snakes, whatever. He was just a desert rat. He just fell in love with it.
Oh, I thought that was cute.
Which it does seem like just optimal childhood. So
yeah,
fun.
Totally.
Less than 50 yards away from the Johnsons' new home stood an old, what Stack describes as a shed. Mm-hmm. Once used by copper miners as a powder magazine. So basically, it's not a wooden shed. It's like made of really big stones and is a pretty small structure used to hold explosive gunpowder when copper miners were working in the area a long time ago. And the structure also has a door on it. So it became a playhouse for Scott and his friends, and Sue could see the shed from her home and would watch the kids play in and around it, which, again, dream.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that would have been my dream.
On April 3rd, 1974, at 3:45 p.m., the Bullhead City Volunteer Fire Department responded to a call that the old powder magazine was on fire. Former Bullhead City Fire Chief Larry Adams worked to clear the smoke and remove material from inside the shed that seemed to be burning quickly. When he removed the material and could see through the smoke, he was shocked and horrified to find two badly burned bodies. And the bodies were of Scott Johnson and one of his friends. And in the segment, the friend is not mentioned by name, which is also interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And his family is not interviewed at all, but he was a six-year-old named Peter Hill. So 2 6- and 7-year-old boys died. 7 weeks later, the coroner concluded that the two boys had died accidentally, suggesting they were probably playing with matches and gasoline when the shed caught fire. So Sue Johnson, this poor mother, did not believe that. She says, "I was shocked, very shocked. My child was certainly smarter than to just lay in the back of a building and wait to be asphyxiated by smoke or burned by fire."
Yeah.
Which, just hearing a mother describing what happened to her son.
Yeah.
Knowing she's pictured it and thought about it and then has to fight the coroner's ruling is so sad.
Yeah. Yeah, like there's certain human instincts that I feel would not allow that to happen.
No. She says, "It's just an obvious thing. I always knew it was murder, always." But Sue Johnson was not alone in her opinion. From the beginning, former Fire Chief Adams also believed that Scott and his friend, Peter, were victims of foul play. He, when he was assessing the shack after the fire was put out, noticed that the door of the shack had not been locked or obstructed in any way. And he says all anybody had to do to escape that building was push on the door. In this case, a building, 6x6, they would hit that door and escape the building, had they been able to. So the door can swing open from the inside and swing out. And if there was no foul play, there should be no reason that the boys stayed inside the building. But then, a few feet from the door, he found, in his investigation, a 2x12 wooden plank. Adams thought it was odd that the board had a small, charred circle on one side. He says, "It indicated to me that somebody had prevented the boys' escape through that door. They may have initially tried to just hold the door, but the metal parts got hot, and they couldn't hold the door any longer. Oh. They would need something to insulate them from the heat, so they picked up the 2x12, which, by the way, this is a very serious discussion, but this man does pronounce that 2x12.
Oh, yes, honey, he does.
A few different times he does he say 2x12. 2x12. And one on each end or more, and held the 2x12 against the door with one person on each end of it. Yeah. And there was like a hole in the door that would have caused that half moon shape to be burned into the wooden plank. Yeah. If someone was using that and holding their hand against it to not get burned.
Yeah, I thought that was a really smart assessment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So despite this evidence and the just very unrealistic, like you said, human instinct to escape a burning building, which the boys would have done.
Sure. Like, it's not a baby. It's a six-year-old.
If they could have. Yes, yeah. 6 and 7. Mm-hmm. They could get out. They played in this thing. They know how the door works.
Yes.
Yeah.
But despite all that, police closed the case and ruled it an accident. As the months went by, Sue Johnson continued her efforts to have the case reopened. In 1978, Dale Gordon Meador, a convicted felon, came forward with interesting information. So Meador was serving time at a county jail in New Mexico. At the time of the fire, he was living in Bullhead City, though. Former Detective Robert L. Melton was one of the men who spoke with Dale Meador, and he said, "There was knowledge. Meador advised us that he was driving by the powder magazine and saw two men holding two young kids and pushing them into the building.
One of the kids looked like he was heavily drugged or something, and the other was fighting. Then he saw one of the men with a gas can. One of them told him in street terms to get lost.
Fuck off, bud.
Yeah, exactly. And that they'd just burned up two kids.
Okay.
I mean, and this is horrible. Reenacted and it's horrible.
Yeah.
But also, why the fuck did it take you 5 years to come forward?
Yeah.
So Dale Meador told police that he saw these two men. He did drive away. But then in 1976, he ran into one of them while he was serving time at a prison in Nevada. Authorities questioned that man and the man that Meador accused of setting the fire, but they were unable to make a case against him. However, other witnesses who originally came forward backed up Dale Meador's account. So then we're introduced to two new people who apparently witnessed something that day. And they're actually the first people who reported that the shelter was on fire. So at the time, they were a teenage couple, and their names are Tina, Mo, and John Callis. And they say, Tina says that she saw two men. There were two men. One was standing on the side of the hill facing the door of the shack, and the other one, well, he didn't like the idea that we were there, and he took off and went running. I don't know if this means then that Meador saw it and drove off, and then this teenage couple saw it, and they just didn't see each other, but because it's like a very pretty remote area.
Yeah.
Like, then John Callis, who was with Tina, says, that's when I said, also, this reenactor is so fucking horrifying. He is so scary when he's looking at the burning, watching it. It made you feel like, are they trying to paint him as he's a bad guy? Which I'll get back to. He says, that's when I said, you know, Tina, I think we should go call the fire department on this because I think those guys set this place on fire. And that's when we left. So John and Tina told police about the two men they had seen. However, John believes their statements were ignored because of their own previous scrapes with the law.
Oh.
Quote, it didn't seem like they took it seriously at all. It seemed like they didn't believe my story, and from my past reputation, they seemed like they just disregarded it, and I never heard anything more about it. So, as time passed, the tragedy faded from public memory, except, of course, for the families of the victims. And Sue Johnson says, you wonder if there is someone who just wanted this tucked away quickly and for good. Or was it just a sloppy investigation or just circumstances? I honestly feel that it was a combination of a lot of things. I feel like Sue is really smart because I think that's often what it is. It's often not just one thing. It's like a confluence of terrible events that makes something not be solved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1989, Dale Lent became the new chief of detectives in the area, and he reopened the case as a murder investigation. He says, I've talked with Sue on the phone and in person many times. I told her in the beginning when I started out that there may not be an answer to this, but we're going to keep looking. So, of course, the question is, why would anyone, if the boys were murdered, which to me it seems like they were, but why?
Yeah.
Why would someone murder two young boys who are just playing out there? And I feel like we see this a lot, but one clue has driven the investigation to a very common theory that we see, which is that the boys ran across a drug drop area. So 3 weeks before their death, Scott found a $100 bill just lying in the brush near the structure and took it to his mom.
Hmm.
So Sue Johnson believes, like, maybe obviously that came from drug money, but then maybe the boys saw more than that later, and whoever it is, maybe these two men that people claim they saw were part of that and killed them so they wouldn't tell anyone about them. Which is so fucking stupid if that is the case.
I mean, they're 6 and 7. Like, what are they gonna, you know?
You can, and also you can scare a 6 and 7 year old into not saying anything and they will not say anything. You don't have to murder them.
Yeah.
But also, if it is like a drug drop area and they saw it, just never go back there. They're not going to be able to describe you. You look like every other white man with a mustache in the 80s. Like, that almost makes me more mad. I mean, it's horrible. Either way, and it's horrible if they were murdered, but that, and any murder would be senseless, but that especially feels just like so egregious. Callous to me.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Sue Johnson refuses to give up hope. She says, it's very hard to live every day of your life and wonder why your son was murdered and why no one's ever done anything about it after all these years. I hope that whoever did it gets to pay for what they did someday. I don't care how long it takes. I've been patient this long. I can wait longer if that's what it takes. So, of course, detectives and Unsolved Mysteries were hoping that someone would come forward in the case.
Yeah.
But no one ever did, and it's still unsolved.
Oh.
So I just have a couple of things. Unfortunately, Sue Johnson's very difficult to look up because it's a very common name, so I'm not even sure if she's still alive anymore. But on the Unsolved message boards, I saw a couple things. So one thing I thought was interesting is that people on there are saying they think Tina Moe and John Callis should be investigated. So they're the teenage couple who were the first ones to report the fire.
Yeah.
But people think maybe they had something to do with the actual killings, or they caught the place on fire. You know, I don't know. People think they might be more involved than they say they are.
Okay.
Then this man named Mike Hill posts on there in 2015, and he said, the other victim was my brother.
Oh.
I didn't know half of this info. Parents didn't talk about it. My son looked it up and showed me.
Aww.
I was in same grade as Scott. And then he posts again, my brother's name was Peter Hill. Scott Johnson was actually my friend, but for some reason he was hanging out with my brother.
Oh, wow.
And found a $100 bill. I don't know if the $100 bill had to do with anything, but it still could be a good piece of evidence. Peter was 6 years old and was a very inspirational brother. I will always remember him as a caring brother. Rest in peace, Peter. My family and I will miss him always.
Oh, God.
And then this person responded to him. She just goes by Jen, and she says, hey, Mike, my name is Jen. My mother is Scott's sister. So she would have been Scott's niece. Mm-hmm. So Scott would have been my uncle. I truly hope someday this will get figured out.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, now the nieces and nephews are looking into their...
I mean, it's horrible.
It's truly so horrible.
Just to think, like, killing children is one thing, but to do it in that way is, like, so...
And you're making the decision that whole time to have to hold that door long enough for them to pass out.
Yes. And that is, like, I don't understand how that could be drug drop related. That seems... It seems like something really else happened excessive. To those little boys before they were murdered, I think.
Yeah. And then just two more. There's an anonymous poster from August of this year, and they said, I always wondered if the tip I gave a few years ago about this case was looked into.
Hmm.
We have a longstanding family rumor that was told to me where they confessed to a similar crime in that area. No one wanted to call the police out of fear. Maybe an official will see this and let me know if it was investigated.
So. I feel so bad for people that give tips. I think a lot of people that give tips don't realize that they're never going to hear about it. Like, no one's ever going to get an update. But it doesn't mean that it's not being investigated. It's just that they're not going to get updated as civilians. And I think, like, because you see that a lot, especially, like, on the Doe Network and stuff like that. Unsolved, people are like, I called this tip in and I think it's really valid. It doesn't mean they're not looking at it. It's just they're not going to get back to you and tell you, you know.
Or the people think maybe I need to follow up, like maybe they are so busy and what if this is the right thing, I need to keep following up with it or whatever.
Yeah.
And then just the last one, this is from 2016. This person, Link, said, I was an 11-year-old runaway in 1974. Many of us kids were from L.A. foster homes. Arizona was a popular spot to transport dope. Kids were the best mules. We did not draw attention from, quote, the man. This was a very bad scene that happened in Bullhead City. And he's describing another case. A kid slash courier was hurt slash wounded. Cash was missing for the drop. The dealers went looking for the money. Found two boys. So they're saying maybe they
mistook these boys for the couriers that missed the drop or whatever.
But they're so young.
I know.
A 6 and 7 year old is so different from an 11 year old that ran away from a foster home.
Right.
I mean, six, really?
Six. Come on. That's our kids.
That's our kids. Like, there's no way that you could mistake a 6 year old kid for a drug mule. I'm sorry.
Unless they were using 6 year old kids for that.
I can't even imagine how you would organize a 6 year old kid.
No.
Oh, I know. I cannot even get my kid to get dressed. So
There's no way that our daughters are running drugs for us. It's just not going to happen.
Unfortunately. That was our one hope.
I guess our backup business is out.
Seriously. There goes our side hustle.
So anyway, it's just no answers. Very sad and unfortunate and... They're so cute. Scott Johnson is so, doesn't matter what they look like, but oh my gosh, you can just picture them right in front of you and you can picture them playing and so sad.
It's so sad.
Just the worst.
Oh, yeah. I cannot believe this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This episode's a little challenging.
Oh my goodness. It sure is. Yeah. That's it.
Okay. Good job.
Sorry.
Hey Resolvers, it's Carlin, and I wanted to tell you guys about a cool new app called Beacon. Beacon is a navigation sharing app that lets one or more people share ETA and arrival notifications while keeping location private. Traffic in Portland is no joke, and my husband and I are constantly texting each other to find out when the other person's going to be home so we know when we can get dinner started. So Beacon is perfect for us. You just drop a beacon on the map, share it, and hit start. The app will stay up to date as your conditions and route change so the other person always knows when you're going to arrive. Allison, Eliza, and I are also always sharing our location with each other just for safety purposes in case anything happens. You know that true crime mindset, honey. So Beacon is perfect for making sure we know the other person has arrived to their destination safely. Beacon takes privacy and safety seriously, so it's safe to share with acquaintances or strangers since it will just share your ETA to the destination and not your actual location. Go to www.beacon.site. That's www.beacon.site to learn more and install the app.
Hey guys, it's Carlin. When I'm not listening to true crime, I do love to get down on a good beauty podcast or beauty YouTube show, but it's really hard to find a guru that's relatable and that I can actually learn something from. But I found this podcast called Beauty Uncovered, and basically each episode is just a casual interview with an expert in a certain area, whether that be beauty, health, wellness, or lifestyle. And I just find it really informative, and it's stuff you can actually apply to your real life, which I think is really cool. So subscribe now to the Beauty Uncovered podcast on Apple Pods or wherever you get your podcasts and get your weekly guide to uncovering your beauty. All right, everybody, that's the end of part one. And what are we going to be talking about next week in our part two?
Well, I have another really sad, stressful segment. It is the wanted segment of Angela Hammond.
Oh my gosh, you guys.
Living nightmare, full on nightmare scenario.
Oh my gosh. And then we have a missing person, Lee Young.
Oof.
Okay. Okay. We'll see you next week.
We love you so.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies in the mail. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at resolvemysteriespodcast and on Facebook and Twitter at resolvethepod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, 14005, Portland, Oregon, 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story or cold case or any nostalgia you have surrounding the show, send it our way because we love to hear from you. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review and tell a friend or tell 2 or tell 3. Don't forget, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different nonprofit.
I'm recording.
Me too.
As well.
Okay. I will clap.
Great.
One, two, three. Oof. Not as good. Not as good for me over here.
Two of them were together for me.
It was you. I know what she's that saying means. It was you. Mm-hmm.
No, she's saying it was you.
No,
and
it was me,
Carlin,
and someone else. I don't know. I don't know which.
How diplomatic of the clap judger.
I'll never know who. All right.